Welcome to the new Tyndale House podcast. We're working to make high-level Bible research available to you to help you understand the Bible more and explore reasons why the Bible can be trusted. Tyndale House is an international centre for Bible research and a community of Christian Bible scholars in Cambridge, England. In this first series, Dr. Andrew Ollerton will sit down with three Bible scholars to discuss the reliability, relevance, and reality of the four gospel accounts. In this episode, Andrew Ollerton of the Bible Society and writer of the Bible course continues his conversation from episode one with Dr. Peter Williams, principal of Tyndale House and the author of Can We Trust the Gospels and The Surprising Genius of Jesus, both published by Crossway. A key question for whether or not the four Gospels are credible is, who were the authors of these books and can we trust their testimonies?
Well, Andrew Walton here. Thanks for joining us for part two with Dr. Peter J. Williams. We're at Tyndale House, where Peter is the principal, and we're talking about, well, can we trust the Gospels, really, the reliability of the text that we have, the four Gospels in the New Testament that give us our access, really, today to the life of Jesus. Peter, thanks for joining us again.
Great to be with you.
So last time, we gave a bit more of a general setup to the Gospels, I suppose, and a little bit of your journey. You're in the academic world, and you've, I suppose, been through the mill a little bit in terms of what, you know, are these texts reliable? And we live in a context where that gets pretty well tested and challenged. But you've come to a place of real confidence. I mean, how would you summarize your position? What do you think that, in terms of the status or quality of the Gospels, how would you summarize their accuracy? And
I think they're totally trustworthy and completely amazing. But there's a question, a difference between what I personally hold about them and what I think you can easily demonstrate. And in terms of easily demonstrate, I think you can show that they are worthy of everyone's trust.
Yeah, okay. So back to that word trust, we picked up on that in part one, didn't we? That and the trust is both in the Gospels and then through the Gospels, ultimately to the person of Jesus Christ.
Which, yeah, that's right.
Which, as you say, that's what we're used to doing as human beings, isn't it? We trust people or we choose not to, depending on what we sense. So we're going to pick up a bit more detail in part two. Get into the real detail of flora and, and locations and names and all sorts. But before we go there, just in terms of, we've got these four Gospels, not one. Attempts have been made over the centuries, haven't they, to harmonize them into one, and yet maybe that misses the point slightly, that four is good. I say that, let's start with a challenge. Four means that there are differences, and sometimes people say not differences, contradictions.
Yeah, sure.
You know, they pick up on examples where it seems like one gospel says one thing, another gospel says another. People, you know, whether that's the death of Judas and whether that's the details around where John fits the cleansing of the temple compared to the other three gospels.
Yep.
So difference or contradiction, how do you think of that?
What I'd say is I don't mind if there is a contradiction at one level. I think I've written that John's gospel deliberately has lots of contradictions even within it. So you just got one gospel and it will have Jesus saying things like, I didn't come into the world to judge the world, and also for judgment I came into the world, for instance, just to give you one example. And I would say Jesus, as a teacher, used paradox. A lot of teachers do. And so even if we just get down to, you know, his teachings, there's contradiction there. Does that mean it's not true? Does that mean it's not reliable? Does that mean he's not a good teacher? Or does it make you actually sit up and think, wow, I should pay a bit more attention to what's going on, so see if I can learn? So, of course, when you then get four accounts of one life, there are going to be differences. But imagine if you had 400 accounts or 4,000 accounts, there might be even more differences. And so from this sort of logic, you could almost make it so the more accounts you have of someone's life, the less certain you are about anything. So something that's witnessed by one person is somehow more certain than something witnessed by 80,000 people in the stadium, because there are so many different differences between their accounts. This is a silly way of thinking. The fact that there are four accounts should not lead us to think that we can have less confidence in them. But also, the differences that we have are not of the sort that could not possibly be reconciled. I mean, it's not saying that Jesus was born in one country and also that he was born in another country far away.
Let me just give just one example, because it just sometimes it's good to get very concrete, isn't it? What are we talking about? So in John's gospel, Jesus cleanses the temple, seemingly, and John's quite clear in the chronology that this is at the beginning. You know, it's right with around the time of the wedding at Cana. And then in the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, they seem to be very clear that it's within that final week, it's an act of judgment and all that. You know, what you talk about reconciling these differences. Yep. Just at a personal level, what's your view on how
can that get reconciled? We've got someone who's a protester, and you have an account of them at a protest, and then you have another account of them at a protest at a different time. How do you reconcile those two? Maybe they went to two protests. Mm-hmm. You know, in fact, they probably went to lots of protests. Now, if Jesus finds what's going on in the temple offensive, why would he not protest regularly?
Okay.
You know, I mean, as in, how many times might he have protested about the commerce going on in the temple? Mm-hmm. It could have been quite a number of times. So I'm saying at the outset, there is the possibility that this happens multiple times. People say, well, hang on, people would never let him back into the temple if he did that, and so on. This is completely impractical. And temple's a huge area, and no one has photos of anyone. Mm. So no one knows what anyone looks like, not even the emperor, because, I mean, the emperor's face on the coin actually is made by the metalsmiths who've never met the emperor. You know, just give him a big nose and call him the emperor. So in this, no one knows what anyone looks like. So the idea that this couldn't happen multiple times is... it's absurd. So just at the very outset, I'd say that has to be a possibility. Mm. But there are scholars who would want to say, you know, for various literary reasons, you know, a gospel writer has moved this event. But I'd want to say, for me, there is no problem with this having happened three, four, five times.
Yeah.
There are, you know, differences in the accounts, but at the end of the day, Jesus is a protester, and if you know, an occasional protester, but if he's protesting, you know, it can happen multiple times.
Jesus the protester, yeah, that's good. Yeah, another way of thinking about it. So I get that reconciled precisely because this happened more than one occasion, and therefore we start to think, well, when John, for example, includes this occasion early on, and then later in the gospel he says there's so many other things that we could have said about Jesus that we haven't, you know, there's all the world couldn't hold that content. That gives us a clue then that these gospels are quite carefully crafted for a particular message, right? They're obviously telling the history, but they're also, John's got a particular audience in mind, Matthew, Mark and Luke, and they're seeking to develop their biographies of Jesus with audience and intent. So that in that sense, the difference is they're not contradictions, but at the same time, they are actually giving us a rich diversity of approach to Jesus. Mm-hmm. How could you help us understand the different, I suppose, intentions or audiences of the gospels?
So, I mean, the gospels are each 2-3 hours long. They're snapshots of someone's life. And what you mustn't do is read too much into what they omit. But in terms of what they have, Matthew's gospel has a real emphasis as you go through on Jesus as king, announcing the kingdom, but using lots of royal language right the way through. And of course, the irony is, you know, the crown of thorns at the end and how people are mocking him as a king when he really is. And it ends with him saying that all authority has been given to him and that people should go out making disciples in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Mark's gospel, an emphasis on the way Jesus came secretly in some sense. I mean, John the Baptist prepared a way for him, but also when he carries out miracles, he's telling people repeatedly not to go and announce that. I mean, lots of emphasis on the actions of Jesus there within Mark. Only two major sections, or two or three, of teaching. Luke, lots of parables there, lots of emphasis on events in Jerusalem. Probably a major emphasis in Luke is reversal, where those who are lowly are exalted, and so on. I mean, these things you can find in all of them. And in John, this amazing opening of the gospel about how the Word of God, the Son of God, has always existed with God and has come into the world as the light, and yet people love darkness rather than light, and they reject him. Lots of use of rich irony in John's gospel, lots of use of symbolism. So they all have their different features. But underlying that, you also see a huge unity in the way that Jesus is presented.
Well, let's pick up on that, because you said in the part one that there's a sense in which whilst we're talking about trust here, this isn't some kind of scientific experiment, but nevertheless, there are tests that can be run. That was the phrase I think you used. And in your book, you pick up on this, that the gospel writers were clearly able to include a level of detail that can almost be tested and cross-reference. Can you start to give us then, from your research and others, what are some of the illustrations of detail that the Gospels include that that gives clear evidence that these were based on eyewitness testimony.
So what you can do is you can start by testing at a very basic level their knowledge of the land they're writing about. Do they know the names of towns, villages? Do they use the verbs go up and go down when the land goes up and down? Do they get the right travelling distances and so on?
It's worth saying, isn't it? That's not straightforward, because
it's not straightforward.
If everyone's been to Jerusalem and that area, they'll know the topography is complex, isn't it? You're forever going
there's
up.
There's a and lot then, of undulation. Yeah, okay. And so the fact that they always know that you go down from Cana to Capernaum or from Nazareth to Capernaum, you know, this is not insignificant. And then you can ask, okay, well, do they get the right strata in society? Do they know the different groups that they're around? Pharisees, Sadducees, Herodians, and so on. And yes, they have that knowledge. Do they have them doing the right thing? If you look at the proportions of jobs that there are in the Gospels, are they representing the right sort of economy? Are they representing the coinage right? Are they representing the flora right? When they mention, you know, Palm Sunday and you know, palm branches, you know, are there palm branches? Is there a Mount of Olives? Are there olives on the Mount of Olives? You know, when they mention Gethsemane, which means the press of oil, is there, you know, oil on the Mount of Olives? Yeah, there's sure lots of olive oil. So these are the sorts of things you can test, and you can say, do they really know what they're talking about? And the answer is yes, they do. And it's not that they're just passing one test, they're passing a whole load of independent tests. So if you were to write a piece of historical fiction about somewhere you'd never been, it would be incredibly difficult. I mean, even with a vast amount of research, you would make terrible mistakes. And yet we find that the Gospels don't have these sorts of blunders. Even people's names. I mean, we now have studies on the relative proportion of people's names in the land at the time, and you find that the names are
right. There are trends, right? There are popular names that come in and out of fashion. How have scholars been able to use that for the reliability of the Gospels?
Yes, well, I mean, you know, people in Britain 1,000 years ago, the words names Athelstan and Ethelred were used, but they're not really common nowadays. These things change over time. And so you can look and study the names in Palestine at the time, looking at bone boxes called ossuaries. You can look at historians like Josephus. You can look at the Dead Sea Scrolls. You can make databases of the names, and you find that basically the sorts of names you have in the Gospels for Palestinian Jewish men and women fit. So the top name outside the Gospels is Simon for a man, Mary for a woman. That's also the top name inside the Gospels. And then also with these top names, they add extra things to sort of distinguish them, to disambiguate them. And so Simon, often you'll find when you get a Simon in the Gospels, there's something extra. They're called Simon Peter, Simon the Zealot, Simon the Leper, something that will distinguish them from all the others.
Which is how this particular Simon was actually known. They're so personal, aren't they? I mean, you know, names is really represents the individual. And what I suppose it reminds us of is the life of Jesus is not just some anonymous magic show, right, where he's just parading around faceless crowds of people. We're given the names, the locations, the jobs, the detail, and the families of these people, as if to say Jesus Christ impacted real lives in real places. Just to be clear, in terms of why this matters, but the big why question, you've got all this detail, even down to, as you say, names and flora and locations. But why does that matter? What particular, if you like, what sort of almost conspiracy theories or alternative views about the Gospels are discredited because of that level of detail?
So, I mean, some people have this idea that the Gospels were written a very long time later or in a very different place. Now, they could have been written in a very different place, but they have to be written on the basis either of having been to the land or having had really extended research conversations with people in the land. Either way, the information can get reliable information can get passed down. But the idea that they got things wrong because of some extensive telephone game method, that is falsified by this, because simply you wouldn't get those sorts of details passed down if it were going through many, many steps.
So the sort of the church invented Jesus as the Son of God. Centuries later, it just you couldn't have the gospel accounts we have.
Yeah, it does make sense, and I mean, apart from the fact that, you know, there are copies of the Gospels from 2nd and 3rd century, and there are quotations from them, and so on. But if the church made made Jesus up, they would make up a completely different Jesus. They wouldn't make up the Jewish Jesus that we have in the Gospels, because the church wasn't so interested in Judaism by that time. They would have Jesus tell you how to run a church service. He never does in the Gospels. They'd tell you how to include Gentiles. He never does in the Gospels. All the sorts of things that you would want him to teach about. If people were putting stuff onto his lips, that's the sort of stuff people would put, and it's not what you've got. What you've got is authentic speech from the time and place. It's got linguistic patterns that fit that place. It's got words that fit that time and place.
And could you just comment then to this thing? Because I think, I mean, I find this very compelling. I really enjoyed both your book, and there's plenty of other research. I mean, it's worth saying, isn't it? I think that there's a sort of mine of research that's, that's really changed the conversation about how reliable the Gospels are, at least in terms of the historical details, in, what would you say, the last 20 years or so?
Yeah, I mean, Richard Borkum's book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, is a very key book, but there are other things as well that just accumulate to show the sort of depth of detail there is.
But just on the question then, so how far can this get us? Because, okay, so potentially all of the local detail, the individual names, who their father was, where that's referenced, what kind of tree. I mean, I love the story of Zacchaeus. It's a good example, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Where you get this, not only given his name, but the sycamore tree, which, I mean, what's the point there?
And this is a story set in Jericho. Mm-hmm. And Jericho, because it's one of the lowest cities on earth, actually has got a different climate from most other cities in Palestine. And, you know, it records that there's a sycamore tree that he climbed up. And of course, that is something that is recorded elsewhere, that there were sycamore trees in Jericho.
So let's assume that's all accurate.
Yeah.
But what do you say to the argument? Well, okay, so they got the tree right and they got all the detail right, but actually, because on the way into Jericho, Jesus, it's claimed, healed a blind man, right? Blind Bartimaeus, again, we're given his name. But what's your answer to, well, maybe they got all of the detail right, that really, but that actually didn't happen. You know, so the details there, but it's still possible that the stories are fabricated.
So sometimes people have this idea that stories get fabricated because they get passed from mouth to mouth through many steps and get exaggerated. And the problem with that is that if you were passing it through many steps, you wouldn't get the peripheral details right, the plausibility of the Aramaic mixed with Greek name Bartimaeus and so on. These sorts of details wouldn't be all in place. You'd have to imagine that people corrupted the most important part of the story, namely the miracle, and left the peripheral parts in place. You'd have to have a mechanism for selective corruption of information. That's problematic. But also, I think that there is a level at which, of course, we cannot prove and demonstrate that miracles took place. I'm not ever arguing that you can. But what I'm saying is, when we do these historical tests, they work on the Gospels. And if we then decide, I could never believe a miracle, you will reject the Gospels. But you're not doing that because the history fails. You're doing that because of your presuppositions against miracles. And when you look at the person of Jesus, Jesus is not just any old person. He's presented as God coming into the earth to show us who he is. And when you realize that, look, if there's a God, how difficult can it be for him to do miracles? It's not difficult at all. And if you don't trust in this God, you have the alternatives that you have to think about, that you're probably going to believe in all sorts of secular type miracles to get conscious beings here. You know, so it's not a choice between believing in miracles or not. I think what you have effectively is you've got to look at the Gospels as a whole and say, does this make sense of life? You can do the historical tests, but you also can look at this as a question of life. And when every time you get up and devote any time or energy to anything, you've decided it's worthwhile. Everyone's already doing that with their lives. So the question is, what are you currently committing your life to? Can you prove to me it's worthwhile, more worthwhile than life following Jesus as recommended in the Gospels?
So we've looked at the Gospels and their reliability, these four Gospels, but they're not actually the only sources about Jesus, are they? I know they're the most comprehensive, but can you just tell us a bit more about, even if for whatever reasons people are not persuaded by these Gospels are biased, what other sources are there that give us history on Jesus?
Well, we do have other sources. For instance, the Roman writer Cornelius Tacitus writes about the great fire in Rome that took place in the year 64. He was a young child at the time, but he talks about how this began and that Nero was getting blamed for it. And so he decided to blame a group that was named after Christ. And Christ had been put to death, specifically, he says, in the reign of Tiberius. So sometime between the year 14 and the year 37. And that happened when Pontius Pilate was in charge of Judea. And so he locates the place. And we know Pontius Pilate from other sources was in charge from the year 26 to the year 36. So again, just from the accounts of Tacitus, you can work out something about when Jesus was put to death. You also have Josephus, who writes about Jesus on a couple of occasions. One of the times, he actually talks about Jesus having this brother called James. Well, again, that's also found in Mark chapter 6, verse 3, that Jesus has a brother called James, and this person in Josephus' account actually dies because of his religious beliefs. So in other words, it's not just that people far away, the Christians who were persecuted in the time of Nero for their being Christians. And there's also people close at hand, like Jesus' brother James, who died in their beliefs as well. So I'd say you can build up a picture of that. I quite like the account of Pliny, the governor of Bithynia, writing to the emperor around the year 111 or 12 and saying, so many people in my area have become Christians that the temples are almost deserted. And that confirms something of the spread of Christianity. But also he tests people on whether they're Christians by, are they prepared to curse Christ? And he finds that these people are, he can test whether someone's a Christian or not based on whether they're prepared to worship the Roman gods and the emperor. Why would that work as a test? Because these people aren't prepared to accept other gods because, you know, following Judaism, you only have one God. And yet, as he records what these people do, he records that they meet and they sing together as Christ, as to a God. So how can they be counting Jesus as a God if they only accept there is one God? Well, because clearly they are identifying Jesus as that God of the Jews. So all of these things you can put together from non-Christian sources. But obviously, the most enthusiastic people about Jesus are Jesus followers, and they're the people who wrote the most. And you shouldn't write off their testimony just because they're Christians. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, if you were accused of something terrible and but your testimony was discounted from being able to defend yourself in your innocence because someone said you're, you know, too invested in proving your innocence. It that doesn't seem to make any sense.
Yeah, and you used the analogy in your book, didn't you? If you were going to read a book on badminton, for example, it's probably written by someone who's passionate about badminton, isn't it? You know, there's nothing wrong with that. Sure. It's still an accurate guide to the game, kind of thing. And I suppose I found that helpful. But I think those sources, those extra biblical sources, if you like, sources outside the Bible about Jesus, not only do they, I suppose, remind our rather sceptical secular Western audiences that you cannot really doubt the historical existence of Jesus in any credible way. Not only that, they actually do give us some insights, don't they? And I mean, hearing what you're just picking up, the letters of Pliny particularly, the resilience of Christians and the impact of Christians in the world is quite extraordinary.
Yes. I mean, I would just say that I think people can doubt the existence of Jesus. And the reason why is because we all know nowadays how to call in expertise to support what we already want to believe. And it's an amazing phenomenon you can see nowadays. Let's say, illustrate it from politics, where people can easily bring in the evidence they want to support the case they do, but people do this with science as well and other things. So if someone wants not to believe in Jesus, people are intelligent enough to find excuses.
You're having to fight your way through a lot of evidence to get there, right? And I think it leaves every human being with the simple question, who is Jesus? Because he definitely existed.
Absolutely.
And that's an important question to answer. Pete, that's great. Thank you so much for talking with us. And I certainly think for our listeners, that just that sense of confidence in the Gospels from a sheer historical accuracy point of view has been raised. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Tyndale House podcast, which was a re-release from the Trusting the Bible podcast, produced by Tyndale House Cambridge in collaboration with the Bible Society. In our next episode, Andrew Ollerton talks to Dr. Dirk Jonkin, Academic Vice Principal of Tyndale House, Cambridge, about the process through which the Gospels were preserved and came to be written down.
It doesn't rely on the testimony of one person. We have four accounts. So it was a multiple lines of memory of transmission that were existing side by side. The other great thing is that communities are very resistant to changing of the tradition.
In future series, we will be exploring how to make sense of the Old Testament, digging into names in the Bible and the ancient world, and talking in depth to some of the people who study and work here in the Tyndale House Library. Please subscribe to the Tyndale House Cambridge podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts so that you don't miss out on later episodes. It really helps others to find this podcast if you pass it on to your friends and colleagues, and if you rate and review it.